This is Everyday We're Hustling. I'm Miranda Campbell. More and more, young people are trying to turn their creative projects into careers. Getting this going involves struggle, commitment, and a whole lot of work. Everyday we're hustling. Our guests work in different creative fields, but what they have in common is this hustle. Pursuing a creative career means juggling artistic and economic demands. It's a constant balancing act, and the road to making a living isn't always clear. So, how are young people managing all this? In our final episode, we're going to sum up our exploration of making a living from creative work with one final overarching theme, hustling. This episode's focus is on the day-to-day grind. Young people are holding down multiple jobs and are always on the lookout for the next gig. What do you do between contracts when times are lean? And what about long hours and busy times? How do you find time for yourself when every day you're hustling? Emma Healy is a freelance writer and poet. Her first book of poems, Begin With the End in Mind, was published by Arbiter Ring in 2012. Emma was the recipient of the Irving Layton Award for Poetry in 2010 and 2013, as well as a National Magazine Award nominee in 2015. She's also the Globe and Mail's poetry critic and a regular contributor to the Toronto Star and music blog Said the Gramophone. Emma's currently working on her new manuscript of poetry. Hi, Emma. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
So when people ask you what you do, what do you say?
Usually I say that I'm a writer. That's sort of just my general thing. Lately, I've been telling people more that I'm a poet first, but that's definitely, even though I've been writing poetry for a long time and I published a book of poetry 4 years ago, I think I technically qualify. It's, I'm kind of reluctant to lead with that. So usually I never used to say it. And now sometimes if I'm feeling bold, I'll say that I'm a poet, but most of the time I just say that I'm a writer.
And why do you feel reluctant to say to people that you're a poet?
I don't know. I think it's kind of, it's a tricky thing to tell people. I think people sometimes don't know how to respond to it. And then other times they don't, take it very seriously. And so it's a weird thing where there's a little bit of self-protection in it. It's just like a hard one to lead with, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you find that saying you're a writer feels safer.
Yeah.
Do you feel like it also gets a better reaction? Do people accept that when you say you do that? Or do they still have follow-up questions about what being a writer means?
People generally want to know what your day job is. Like, it seems more aspirational, I think, to people. And then if you say, well, yeah, that's like my, that's my whole job. I like kind of, I just freelance. That's what I do. People are always like a little, like not taken aback, but it takes a minute to adjust, I think. And I, you know, I had day jobs for like a really long time, and I probably will again in the future. But most people are used to writers being people who have like a day job first and write kind of second.
So can you tell us about some of those day jobs you've had?
Yeah, absolutely. I started working day jobs when I was in high school. Both my parents are artists. They're both writers and actors. And when I was a kid, I saw them both. Just like my mom catered all through my childhood. My dad had like restaurant jobs. My mom did this thing called standardized patient, which is where you pretend to be sick and then doctors pretend to figure out what's wrong with you, like for their exams. And so I started doing that when I was in high school, and I did it all through university. I would come back to Toronto and do it. And I ended up like administrating like medical school exams in the summertime. And so that was how I made a living kind of through university, is I would do that like on breaks and I would do it over the summer. And then I've done a lot of different stuff. I've been a technical writer. I've been a copywriter. I've been an editor and a proofreader. I've done, I've been a secretary. I've briefly managed a massage therapy clinic for like a bit, just sort of like different things that would sort of fit in to where my life was at different times, I guess. But the one consistent thing through all of those jobs is that I would have a job for anywhere between 2 and 8 months, and then I would quit.
So you've also done unpaid internships at The Walrus and at ECW Press. Was there value in those?
The Walrus one is a little strange. That wasn't a real, I didn't do the internship program that they have there. It was that when I was in high school, I was in the 12th grade and I'd finished most of my classes. My school didn't have a co-op program, but I asked them if I could kind of make one because I wasn't doing anything else. And I basically just wrote to a bunch of different places and I said, like, I'm in high school. I just want to learn stuff. Can I come in and like sweep your floors? Can I like just like intern for your interns, basically? And Jared Bland, who was the editor at The Walrus at the time, I guess like took pity on me and was like, sure. And so he let me come in. I think I was going twice a week. And I was sort of interning for the web editor there. So I ended up just like doing the stuff that nobody else there wanted to do, which mostly involved like editing and proofreading stuff for the website.
Interning at a literary magazine or a small press. Mm-hmm. Did you come away with anything that was useful for your own career of freelance writing or working as a poet?
Absolutely. I would say that one of the most useful things that I ever did for myself as a writer of any kind was to put myself like on the other side of a slush pile. Do you know what a slush pile is?
What's a slush pile?
A slush pile is it's the sort of like huge box or inbox of like unsolicited submissions that any publisher or magazine has. Just like people just sending in stuff and being like, this is my book, this is my whatever. And I saw it at The Walrus, and then I also saw it at ECW when I was working there. And it really gives you a sense of both like what other people are sending in on a kind of like day-to-day basis to places like that, and also of what editors are dealing with. And because I got to see those things like right at the start of my career, like I worked at ECW when I was in the summer after my first year of undergrad. And so I was like just starting to send things out to literary magazines. And it really gave me a sense of like how busy everybody is and how just like completely overwhelmed and how they're just like every editor is just scrambling to cobble stuff together like constantly. And so I really got to have an idea of like when I'm pitching something to somebody, there's a reason that you want to keep it concise. There's a reason why you want to give people something to grab onto, like, you know me from this thing, or like, I met you this one time, or like this, like, but also you don't want to be too pushy. You don't want to, like, it's just, it's easier to understand those things when you've seen the other side of it and the sort of day-to-day operation of it. And I think that I probably would have done a lot worse as a writer, like early on, if I hadn't understood what it was like to be an editor.
When you were at Concordia, you started an online magazine called Incongruous Quarterly.
Yes.
With a friend.
Yeah.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about that magazine?
Absolutely. It actually came out of the two internships, and it was sort of the other side of, I guess, being on the other side of the slush pile or seeing a lot of what people were submitting to magazines and to publishers. Because even though what I found extremely helpful about that was that I learned how much work everybody has to do and how busy everyone is constantly, I also felt a little weird seeing a lot of the submissions that I was going through as like the intern who was basically just, my job was to reject stuff. Because a lot of what I was rejecting was actually pretty good. And it's just that the place that I was working for didn't have room for it, or wasn't interested in like submissions from people that the editor didn't know at all. And I got kind of bummed out because I was a young writer who didn't feel like I had a place in this community at all. And I was sort of wondering about how I was going to start out and like if I wanted to write weird things that didn't quite fit anywhere, like what was going to happen to me and to my friends. And so I started a magazine whose sort of gimmick was publishing the unpublishable. So stuff that deserved to have a home somewhere, but wouldn't necessarily be able to find it anywhere else. Because we wanted to just publish stuff that was like, just too long or too strange or like too conceptual, or like maybe the material was like not exactly like CanCon type stuff. Or just stuff from writers that didn't have anything else on their resume or didn't have like a social media presence or didn't really like people who just sort of came out of nowhere. We wanted to give them a home, and we wanted to be respectful also, like, was a big thing. Because I was writing all these, it was almost a sort of like personal antidote to all the rejection letters that I was writing all the time working for these other places, because it felt really bad to be sending form letters that were in some cases like on purpose supposed to discourage people from submitting again. And it felt bad to be doing that all day. And it was almost like doing a kind of like penance where I wanted to make up for doing that by like really encouraging people to do weird stuff and giving that weird stuff a home. That was sort of our goal.
How long did Incongruous Quarterly run for?
We published from 2009 to 2012-ish. And it was great because it started out really, really small. And part of our whole mission statement was that we wanted to respond to like every writer who submitted to something to us. We wanted to respond to them personally. We would never send like a form rejection letter. We would never do this. We would like talk to you about the thing that you had sent us, which was easy when we had like 20 people sending us stuff. But then the problem was that we got a lot of cool people on board really early on. Like one of our first guest editors was like Sheila Hetty, and she did a thing for us where she got like a bunch of her writer friends to submit things to us. And so suddenly we had stuff that like we had a sort of, again, like a gimmick that people were interested in. And then we had a couple of names. And so suddenly we were doing, like, I was doing interviews about it for, like, the CBC, and we were getting a lot of press coverage, and people were really interested in it, and our submissions blew up. And suddenly there were, like, a ton of people sending us things, and it was really, really hard to keep up with, because we were all, like, full-time students also. It just became really, really hard to keep up with it in a way that was, like, you know, that was like true to the goals that we had started out with, and that was also like let us stay sane. But I think that the thing is that it started small and it was supposed to stay small, and when it tried to get bigger, it just sort of collapsed under its own weight. And so we ended up, I think we had big ambitions for sort of making it bigger and bigger as it progressed. And then after a certain point, I sort of realized that it was maybe time for it to stop. So we published, I think, 5 or 6 issues total, and then it folded. But I was really proud of the stuff that we did do in that time. And it was a really useful thing just in terms of like knowing what editors are up against.
So you've done a number of day jobs, and you've done some unpaid internships, and you've started up your own projects. How do you pay the rent now?
Mostly freelancing. The past little while, in the past year, I've had a couple of arts grants that have really, really helped to work on a new manuscript of poetry that I'm working on. And so those have sort of helped me to get through like leaner freelancing times. But the more freelancing I do, the less I necessarily need that stuff, like in a consistent way. I also will supplement it with small like editing or copywriting jobs. So I publish a lot, and I write a lot of things for a lot of different places. But also I'll do, like, I had an editorial gig last fall working at Toronto Life for a month. And that gave me like a chunk of money that kind of saw me through till Christmas. So there was sort of, it's a balance between just writing and publishing and pitching all the time. And then also like every once in a while, a sort of like bigger job will float your way and sort of help you bounce back from maybe a leaner time. But it's a pretty paycheck to paycheck kind of situation.
Can you tell us a little bit about what a typical day might look like right now? I imagine if you work freelance, do you work a lot from home?
I do, yeah. I work pretty much entirely from home. I'm very lucky in that I live in an apartment that has, I live with 2 roommates, but we have like enough space in the house that everyone's a freelancer and everyone can sort of be in their own zone, which hasn't always been the case. Like, I used to work a lot in sort of coffee shops and libraries and stuff. And now I get the sort of privilege of being able to work actually from home. But basically, I try to wake up at a regular, at a decent hour. And I'd basically just immediately start working. But it's a real, depending on what I have to do that day, if I have to file anything or if I'm like pitching things or whatever, I sort of, I've started having to sit down in the morning and schedule out exactly how much time I want to spend on each thing that I have to do that day. Because otherwise, like, you're at the computer all day and it can really easily devolve into looking at Twitter, looking at Facebook, looking at the news. Because in the same way that sort of being out can always sort of count as work if you don't set aside time to, like, you know, socialize and then time to meet people. Being online or being, like, sort of on the computer or doing whatever can be sort of work and sort of avoiding work at the same time. And so I've had to really, like, schedule and structure, like, exactly, like, I'm going to spend 2 hours doing poetry and I'm going to spend 2 hours doing this and I'm going to spend some time, like, pitching and writing to editors. And that sort of shifts around, like, day to day. It's never really the same. But the one thing that remains consistent is that I have to, like, set aside time to figure out exactly what I'm going to do every morning and then try to stick to it as much as possible.
And if you don't stick to the schedule that you make for yourself in the morning, do you feel bad about yourself?
Oh, man, so bad. It's really, it's, this is something that I've been thinking about a lot lately because I realized that I was really allowing that sort of diffuse, like, stressed feeling to pervade, like, every part of everything that I was doing every day, where, like, no matter what I was working on, I felt like there was something else that I was neglecting. And no matter what I was doing, I felt like I should have been working, no matter how much work I had actually done that day. And I think that that's a really easy trap to fall into when you are your own employer and when you could, when everything that you do relies on you creating, like, momentum for yourself, is that you always feel as though there's something that you're neglecting or there's always something for you to feel guilty about a little bit. And the scheduling is the way that I've sort of been trying to, like, push it back, is to be like, I'm going to work on exclusively this thing for exactly as much time as I said I was going to. And then no matter what, it's over when it's over, and then I move on to the next thing. And I've sort of been, like, scheduling blocks of time to, like, be happy and, like, not worry about stuff also, which is an interesting one that seems a little insane when I say it out loud. But scheduling time to be like, you know, now I'm going to watch TV and, like, not feel bad that I'm not writing pitches or whatever, like, is a really important one that I'm trying to stick to.
You're also working on your second book of poetry. How does that fit into your schedule?
I take a really long time to write poetry. This is the other thing. This is the sort of difference between when I'm writing for a newspaper or for a magazine or a website, you get a deadline, you write to the deadline, and I'm pretty good at it. Like, I mostly don't miss deadlines or anything. I'm pretty motivated by panic and a sort of short turnaround. But poetry, I take forever. It takes so long just to do one thing. And I write these little, like, sort of paragraphs of, like, prose poetry. And one thing that takes up about a third of the page will take me, like, 6 months to do, because I'll just keep, like, writing and deleting and writing and deleting. And I'll have, like, you know, about 20 pages of, like, solid text that turns into just, like, this one, like, sort of six sentence thing. So it's taking me a really long time to do it.
So for your new manuscript of poetry, you've received grants from the Ontario Arts Council, the Toronto Arts Council, and the Canada Council.
Yes.
In those grants, are you able to put into your budget money for you to live off of?
Yes, that's basically, if you're applying for grants to work on a manuscript, at least, like, the ones that I've applied for, that's basically what the money is for. It's entirely, like, subsistence money so that you can live your life while you're working on the project that you're working on, which is a really wonderful thing to be able to have. And it's nice to be able to be honest, because I've also, like, written, you know, applications for things where, you know, that aren't grants or whatever, where you kind of have to be like, well, I'm going to use it for supplies and I'm going to use it for, so it's nice to just be honest and be like, I'm going to use it to pay my rent and eat, and then to actually be able to use that money for those things.
So it sounds like being a writer means living paycheck to paycheck. Is that comfortable for you?
I think there's, like, definitely a lot of anxiety all the time. I have, because how could you not be anxious if you don't have much money? Like, it's, you know, it's a pretty understandable feeling and it's pretty constant. But I do feel as though, yeah, I've had enough day jobs at this point. Like, it's hard to find a job for sure. But I think that when you're not relying on, like, finding the best possible job or, like, the job that, like, suits your lifestyle the best forever, I do always kind of have this feeling in the back of my head that's maybe a bit of a false, like, security blanket, but I'm always like, I could find a job and do it for a bit and then save up enough money to stop again if I really had to. But there is a lot of anxiety about money just sort of in the day-to-day. And I sometimes you manage it better than others. I think in general, I sort of have like an uneasy truce with how little money I have at any given time. I'm certainly okay with it enough to live.
We can learn a lot from young artists and cultural workers about the process of making a living from creative work. But the products they're creating are also exciting and innovative. Cultural correspondent Jesse Cumming reviews youth creativity in music, film, visual art, literature, and design. This episode, Jesse discusses the work of Calgary-based musician Aleem Khan.
There are only 9 cities in the United States with populations larger than Calgary, Alberta, and only 2 in Canada. But at times, the city can feel like an afterthought. Its dusty frontier history can seem to double for its entire existence, with its cultural life just as dry. Luckily, over the past several years, increasingly diverse arts and culture have been on the rise in Calgary. Some of this has to do with Sled Island, the annual arts and music festival that celebrated its 10th anniversary in 2016. The festival serves as a platform for the city's most interesting artists and musicians. One of these artists is Aleem Khan. Khan performed at this year's festival 2 weeks before the release of his second album, Urbana Champagne. The record comes with a dedication to every resident of Calgary, as well as Urbana, Illinois, his childhood home. The artist describes it as a loose concept album, telling Exclaim magazine that it's the story of a character exploring race, culture, and identity. It also ponders what life would have been like had they not moved to Calgary as a child. Urbana Champagne follows Khan's 2015 self-titled debut and an EP by Shawnee Cage, Khan's R&B project with his brother Kaleem. Both of these releases hinted at Khan's talents. The slow burn of tracks like Deluxe off his debut album are impressive, and Urbana Champagne makes even bigger strides. Much of Khan's self-titled release was built around guitar. Urbana Champagne is a showcase for the multi-instrumentalist's talents and is structured largely around organ and horn. The champagne of the album's title refers to the city next to Urbana in Illinois, yet there is a certain sense of glam that pervades the record, a modest glitz. The sense is evident on Cameo, the album's opener. Throughout the song, ornate trumpets and trombones soar over a cool, lazy organ and Khan's equally laid-back vocals. The musician's distinctive voice is one of his great talents, even if it's not always present on the album. At times, it is honeyed and understated, lilting along with the horns that pepper the record. At other times, it rises, to bellow alongside the most climactic moments. On Refuge, his voice wordlessly weaves itself among loose organ melodies. Khan's songs are shapeshifters. They change form unexpectedly, as if catering to the musician's romantic whims. Yet they're always anchored by Khan's assured croon and swirling organs. Urbana Champagne can be tough to pin down on a track-by-track basis, and just as difficult to place in a broader musical context. It's music too odd and free to align with most indie rock, yet too melodic and song-based to be classified as experimental. There are hints of Sufjan Stevens at his most baroque, or late 80s art rock like Tok Tok, in the album's quietest moments. One might even be tempted to reference prog rock, given the album's constantly shifting structures and song titles like Jubilee Act 1 and 2. Yet Khan's music perpetually redefines itself. In doing so, it escapes tired distinctions in a way that is sincerely exciting. Urbana Champagne came out on Toronto's Slow Release Records in a limited run of 100 cassettes. The scarcity might suggest a modest ambition, or, with 3 releases in 2 short years, an extraordinarily talented musician with no desire to look back.
information about our guests, check the show notes for this episode or our website, everydaywearehustling.com. Everyday We're Hustling is produced by Jesse Cumming. Our program is recorded and edited by Max Cotter, with graphic and web design by Lucy Woke, and music by Adam Wado. I'm your host, Marietta Campbell, assistant professor in the School of Creative Industries at Ryerson University. Everyday We're Hustling is funded by the Creative Innovation Grant at Ryerson University.